Hello, this is News of the World, the 84th edition, and this is Tim Pritlove speaking to you, and you're probably far away because it's summer holiday, and nobody's actually listening to podcasts anymore. Mark, how's the summer in Amsterdam?
It's really hot, tropical. Oh. The world is changing, as we know, climate changing. We're here documenting it, but here in Amsterdam, everybody's living in a tropical paradise.
Wow.
Yeah, global warming has really high approval ratings over here. It's really weird.
Yeah, weather is not bad here too.
Yeah, but no, everybody's listening poolside. Poolside is where you take your podcasts now.
Oh, really?
Or lakeside, if you prefer.
Oh,
for Berlin.
I missed that. Sorry, still locked up in my den. My podcasting den.
Aren't you in a place where people go swimming nearby at a lake or something? They must all have headphones.
I assume they do. I'm just not part of it. That's the problem here. Yeah. So, talking about bad preparation, we thought, let's do another show. Let's do another News of the World, because there has been so much great news out there that we need to talk about.
Yeah, the world has not taken a vacation from doing things. That's for sure, as many of you know. So yeah, why not get back to the news? Got to start with the stuff that's especially big in the mainstream, right? Even if some of these topics, like we'll talk about Israel and Gaza in a moment, they're still going on, so we'll mention them. But I want to focus on some of the more recent developments in other parts of the world. But let's go through the big ones in the mass media right now, starting with airstrikes in Iraq. Yeah, here on this program, and surely in your local media, you've heard about the Islamic State, this breakaway region of Iraq. We've talked about the Kurds. Well, the U.S. is now conducting airstrikes. They started yesterday in the Islamic State areas of Iraq, and specifically, they're saying it, the U.S. government is saying, to help the Kurdish government, which has been losing territory and been under threat from the IS as they try to push towards what I understand to be Erbil, traditionally the city, the capital of what is de facto Kurdistan. So they've been targeting military, of course, always, smart bombs. Here we have these old words again. It's amazing, smart bombs and laser bombs. They're really old technology at this point. And even back when they were new, these names are deceiving because innocent people still do get, of course, hurt and killed. But here we go again with smart bombs and that sort of thing. They love using them in Iraq. And, there's not going to be any troops on the ground, as the U.S. government will tell the people over and over again. But there is going to be this combined drones and aircraft with people in them dropping bombs on targets to try to stop the Islamic State or ISIS or ISIL, if you prefer,
in
the Levant.
That the media really stopped naming them ISIS.
Yeah.
I don't really know why. Maybe just IS is, shorter. Maybe nobody believes that they're going to restrict their activities to the grounds of Iraq and Syria anymore. Mm-hmm. I don't know. But that's something
that has...
It's confusing. But these guys are real trouble. I mean, you can say whatever you want, but this is probably the worst that has happened to this region. And we have covered their first activity in Iraq somehow here and then in one of our shows. And really looks like they are just not interested in dealing with any, reason at all. They are just, spreading their violence and kill everybody. And that's really the problem. And when you mention Erbil, which is sort of the next town in danger to fall, it's interesting to note that this is not just Kurdish area. It's also that the U.S. has some kind of presence there. There's a bureau, as far as I understand it, and there might be a small group of soldiers there somehow to protect this area. So I wouldn't say this is the primary reason, but it might be a part of it. But it's interesting to note that the U.S. somehow now has to admit that, they have done at least two errors, one after the other. First is going there in the first place, and ruining the current order. which was probably not everybody was not a big fan of, but if you compare it to the situation today, it looks really like heaven, the regime of Saddam Hussein. You know, at least it was, you know, it's got this, what you call in the political process, you call stability.
Yes.
You know, stability is probably not a state that is making everybody totally happy, you know, but, you know, you can determine the outcome of activities somehow. It's somehow contained. And in a way, most of the people in Iraq, or the majority of people in Iraq, somehow was better off with that situation, although it was bad for many.
Yeah.
But now everything is just, you know, losing ground. It's a mess.
Yeah. Yeah. And you have a situation, I mean, so many years spent in what they called training the military. The U.S. and allies were training Iraqi military, just like they've been training Afghan military. And the idea is, okay, what's happened has happened. These invading or occupying countries are going to leave, and they've left a military behind that is going to be able to, oh, I don't know, function, defend the borders, maintain some kind of order. I mean, I know the police are for that. They're supposed to be training police too. But here we have a situation where at least some of this Iraqi military has lost badly to the IS or ISIL fighters. And you now have American military equipment being used against the Iraqi government, against the Kurdish government. And, you know, that's what the U.S. is bombing its own equipment. Not that it's about equipment, obviously, but what a bizarre world. Although that's been happening for a long time on this planet. You give arms to someone, and before you know it, they're being aimed right back at you in a different form. One other thing I wanted to add, and it's just one of these details that becomes part of the story. You have a group of people that has never really been in the press, and now they're getting in there. A group of people called the Yazidis, and the Yazidis are one on the list of victims of the ISIL plan, of wiping out things like the Christian minority and the Shiite landmarks. They've got a whole list of things they hate, right?
Yes.
As any good crazy government would. And so now you have the Yazidis getting in the press as a group that is in need of sort of helping because they've been pushed to whatever part of Iraq out of their homes. And that's one of the groups that's now getting food and medical aid dropped over them, right? The bad guys, quote, get bombs and the victims get food dropped on them. Hopefully we don't get those two confused. Unfortunately, historically, it has happened. So, this is the state of things. It's only the second day with these U.S. Airstrikes. I think they're going to continue. They say they're going to get stronger and bigger because so far they've been very targeted. This will go on.
Yeah, the question is really where is it going? Because right now they are, of course, talking the U.S., you know, I mean, the U.S. government is talking about like, okay, yeah, we're sort of helping the situation, we're sort of enabling the Kurds to defend themselves. We're also opening channels to help those who are in desperate need right now, especially the group, what's the name again? Yazidis. Yazidis. They are sort of surrounded by IS troops and, you know, can't get anything. Yeah. But I wanted to point at this subsequent mistakes that the U.S. has done. First, the mm-hmm. mistake was going there. The second was leaving it completely without any military support, you know, because Obama sort of had to, you know, do what he's said he's going to do once he's president, you know, which he did. But in again, it was destabilizing the region yet once more, you know. First, they made it a total mess, and then they made it even worse. And the question is, what are they going to do now? You know, is what they are going to do now helping? Or is this just another escalation point in this whole saga? I don't know.
I think if you're... Yeah, it does get confusing. I mean, look, if you're a fan of the Iraq, the Republic of Iraq, as is supposed to be right now, supposed to be as a country, then, you know, they're supposed to be helping. But it gets confusing because, of course, they're trying to help the government in Baghdad, but they're also trying to help the Kurds in the north. these two interests are not necessarily on the same page with each other. Mm. I'm talking about, you know, how the Iraqi government doesn't want Kurdistan breaking away. And so that's where this gets even further confusing. Since I mentioned the Yazidis, I actually looked it up, and it turns out Time magazine has a special on everything you need to know about the Yazidis. And I just thought I'd mention a little sidebar. They're one of the longest surviving ancient religions or sects in the world, according to a professor from the London School of Economics. And very little known is known about them, and that's how they prefer it. Actually, it says that.
Okay, that plan failed now.
Yeah, well, yeah, right. Now it's coming out. Well, anyway. So there's a small update on what is going to continue to be a very dominant story in the news. And let's move right to another very dominant story. It probably confuses people in terms of ceasefire, no ceasefire. But at this moment, as we're recording, Gaza, Israel, there is no ceasefire. The air strikes, this time from the Israeli government, are continuing, and rockets coming back towards Israel are continuing. And both sides say pretty much the same thing. We're not going to do a ceasefire as long as the other side doesn't stop. And every time they almost have a ceasefire, you know, John Kerry insists there should be a ceasefire, and then it doesn't happen. We've been hearing this for, over a week now, maybe 2 weeks. And I don't even have the totals in front of me of the dead, but you know that it's in the thousands. And there have been numerous smaller stories coming out about who the victims are. And it is sad, among other things. And I watched this all unfold also through Facebook between my Israeli friends, my Lebanese friends, my Palestinian friends. You know, you could really watch the world of, I don't know, public opinion mixed with experience just by Facebook. And it doesn't leave you any more smarter than you were before, but it shows you how divided people are on this whole thing, and emotional and angry, and rightfully so. So that's my Gaza update. I don't know if you have anything to add to that, Tim.
I don't know. There's so many things that go through my mind when I see this, because it's one of the situations in the world, or probably it's like the primary situation, the one, you know, where it's sort of absolutely impossible to tell who the bad guys are,
right.
Really. I mean, I'd say Hamas is really in front here, you know, because the way they tend to operate, you know, what their real aims are. I mean, it's obvious that there's no victory, you know, that they can actually have, and they should know it.
Okay. There are articles that come out occasionally from various Middle East press saying, you know, no matter what, because of the amount of deaths, you know, as long as there's any kind of Hamas still standing, this will be a victory for them. I'm not a big fan of these analyses, you know, who's it a victory for? I mean, I think this is a loss for everyone on all sides. I guess that's really easy to say, but there, I said it.
yeah, true. So, I don't know who's going to bring out the key for this situation, but it doesn't really look good and doesn't really look as if this is going to happen soon.
Yeah, no, and the peace broker in all this, it's not John Kerry necessarily, although he's been going a lot on behalf of the U.S. government, saying we have to have peace. Everybody, of course, ignores him, and maybe he doesn't really mean it either. I don't know, but it's Sisi in Egypt has been the, and that's tradition in many ways. The leader of Egypt, whoever it is these days, tries to have these peace negotiations because he is always the bridge, right, between Israel and Palestine. But this is having little impact.
Yeah, it has little impact. And I don't really know what the solution is going to be like. But this is going on, and we have to report this. And
yeah,
we have reported it now.
Right. And now here we come to a third conflict in the world that's been high on the list over these past few weeks, especially since July. The update from Ukraine, a lot of articles this week about how government forces are closing in on Donetsk and Luhansk. And based on the sheer amount of reporting, and there are a lot of people in that area now, besides the locals, of course, that were always there, but now a lot of journalists, the word is The Ukrainian government is getting closer. The rebels are getting more and more desperate. Many have pointed to key figures that have run off to escape in Russia and left whoever's in eastern Ukraine to keep fighting. A couple of bullet points on this whole thing. I've been trying to keep up with the investigation about the Malaysia airline crash. And it's very, first of all, it's quite hard to keep up with the investigation. I suppose the OSCE or someone has a website that keeps this, you know, keeps the updates coming out. But in the press, it's hard to find. But several times this week, for entire days, they just can't go do the investigation. I think out of the, what are we at? Maybe 7 to 8 days that investigators have officially been on the ground, they've only been able to get to the actual site, I think, half the days. If that, I think maybe it's less than half the days. And this is, I guess the reason it doesn't get into the press is because what is there to say about it other than this is a shame, right? Yeah. But for me, this is still amazing. Like, you cannot conduct an investigation because there's no such thing as a, even around the crash site, as we once thought there might be, a ceasefire area. It's not happening. No. So this is bizarre. You know, there are investigators, and they most days they just say, we can't do our job.
Yeah, and they live in Donetsk, and they have like 2.5 hour drive daily just to get there. Because they have to take a difficult route to get quickly into Ukraine-controlled areas to be safe. And then, you know, as you said, on the crash side, it's also riddled with fightings and other things.
Yeah. Just to keep moving, even though each of these has so much to say about it, we have the new sanctions, this time as a response to the EU sanctions that came from Russia the last few days, and they're targeting what they call, you know, so-called Western food imports. I was just reading, actually, Bloomberg, being a financial news reporting site, has a lot on the money, right, and who and which countries are impacted. And it was just a long thing on the Baltics, so Estonia, Lithuania, Latvia, and Poland, as the first victims of not being able to send what is normally like large chunks of their exports in cheese and milk and agricultural products in general to Russia. So everybody's trying to calculate, you know, what kind of a loss. I've seen American reporters and bloggers claiming that, you know, Putin is starving his own people, which I even tried to argue a little bit. Not that I'm the one who needs to explain Russia to anyone, but I said, you know, he's not starving his people because there's still lots of food to go around, not just from Russia, but there's Belarus is a huge breadbasket for at least Western Russia. And Russia itself does produce the basics food-wise. So this is not a matter of people going hungry. But it is a matter of course, the cost of food and the impact economically on all those who usually export to Russia. And that's a lot of Europe. I did read this item also on gas, and it's interesting to put some of these things together. First of all, as many people probably know, since July, Ukraine doesn't get gas exports from Russia, right? But Europe does. It goes through Ukraine, amazingly.
Yeah.
The Ukrainian government is now saying, or at least the prime minister, who tried to resign, right? And they refused his resignation. I don't understand that. He's now saying they may halt or at least curb gas passing through. That's funny, gas passing. Gas passing through Ukraine. So he could shut down that major pipeline or those pipelines. Now, there are other sources, and we'll link to an article that shows you a short list of three other sources. North Sea is a major route that I think is just about functioning or will be functioning very soon.
Yes.
That is one way that Gazprom and others get their gas into Europe. There's a southern route where Italy is cooperating with Russia. So we'll see here in Europe, we're already seeing it, but we'll see more, I think, when it comes to gas access and countries panicking and prices going up. When I saw that, I was like, wow, they, even though they don't get gas, gas goes through the Ukraine to the rest of Europe. Like, what a strange world we live in. Like,
this is the craziness about the situation in general. You know, here you have two parts of the world that sort of got the act together in the last 20 years to somehow cooperate and that somehow depended on each other. Europe needs the gas, or at least is still very dependent on the gas right now, especially for heating. And Russia, of course, needs Europe just for getting money cheaply on the market to finance their economy. And this is all going. Also, high-tech stuff for the oil industry is probably not only, but mainly from Europe. And so they will have trouble upgrading their equipment. So these are not small topics for Russia. But somehow Putin is just walking forward and saying like, yeah, fuck you. We are not depending on you. And I'm not so sure. If you look at the press articles about this, nobody seems to be so sure he can get away with it. Because even if there's enough food, food prices will definitely rise. And inflation is going up anyway. And the outlook for the companies for the next years is bleak. So it's not, you know, I think they are under real pressure. And somehow it might be that even they have sort of underestimated the EU in terms of, you know, getting their act together and act like a single entity, which they somehow did. You know, that's not something that usually happens in Europe, you know. Russia knows EU as being, you know, torn between many different routes. But in this situation, it sort of comes forward. It's also interesting to see what this might mean for the transition towards renewable energy in Europe, because somehow relying on the gas imports from Russia is one of those things where everybody said like, yeah, it's still, you know, enough for the next 10, 20 years to come. You know, we don't really have to hurry up. But now this becomes a new topic too, you know, speed it up just by using less energy. So this is a very, very, very complicated conflict. And the recent reports of Russia amassing soldiers on the border as well, you haven't really touched on this yet, I guess.
It's on the list,
You know, it's on the list. You know, this is the next scary part. Because what if Russia is actually invading? What if Russia is actually entering this area with their troops? I mean, at least officially. You know?
Right. In the end, it's all very confusing. So whatever I think, it doesn't matter. But I don't know what it means in the near future for all these troops that are apparently amassing on the border. I mean, NATO says it, so it's not just some crazy... Because the Ukrainian government, I find, depending on the official, they have some crazy theories sometimes. So I try not to listen to the Ukrainian government. NATO said, you know, 20,000 troops on the border. I did read a story that seems official. Again, I think it was in Bloomberg, which was about a convoy of Russian military equipment that was coming in to the Luhansk area or Donetsk area, and the Ukrainian military had gotten there in their progress these last few days, and they through diplomatic channels they insisted that this column of whatever it was be turned back, and the Russian officials said, we have no idea what you're talking about, and if there is such a convoy, we will turn it around, and they did. I take these as a sign that the Russian government, why would they officially turn back a convoy? Well, you know, I don't think they want to invade eastern Ukraine, and I know the public doesn't want it either. As much as this whole theory that the world is against us and Crimea is ours, okay, that flew. That was widely accepted, but I don't think people really want this region. And I think that matters, but of course that's not the last thing that matters, because Putin still does more or less what he wants. He has a plan in his mind. So I don't think there's an invasion coming, but I can't explain these bizarre aggression and then non-aggression. Unless to explain it as this is just a game. Threaten, back down. And then, in that sense, all the comparisons to the Cold War are quite accurate, because it was a time of threaten and then back down. But it's really sad. And I just saw this long story on Crimea. It's an interesting time to do stories on Crimea. You know, lots of people from Russia, I heard this a lot in Moscow, want to go, as always, on vacation. Some people feel it's kind of their duty, since they know that the economy is going to be bad down there. Let's go and spend our money and have our vacation time in Crimea. Others say, for many government employees, they have to go there because they're not allowed to leave Russia because of security reasons. Their employers are basically saying, if you're a police officer or if you're a civil servant, here are your vacation choices. And on that list is like Sochi and the Crimea. And so people choose Crimea. But Crimea, meanwhile, is struggling economically. You know, the Russian tourists going are not enough. They just, through the sanctions that the EU put on Russia, one of these low-cost airlines is somehow not allowed to go to Crimea, though they had to basically close. I forget what they're called, but you've heard about them. They were this low-cost Russian vacation airliner. They've gone out of business. That was a major source for Crimea. And meanwhile, Crimea is taking in refugees from eastern Ukraine. So the Russian government operating in Crimea is taking in thousands and thousands of refugees. It's the whole thing is such a disaster. And in a way, it reminds me of what we were just saying about Iraq. Not that any of us want to go back to Saddam Hussein, but you got to wonder in a less than a year, how many people are going to say, old Ukraine, was that so bad? What have we done? What are we? I mean, then again, what did they do? Many of these people didn't cause this to happen. You know, they're just sort of the sheep that have to move around as people drop bombs and, oh, all right.
Yeah, just happened.
Yeah. Let's move to a harder one here. This is health, world health. You've heard about it if you've been looking at newspapers this week. Ebola. And you and I, Tim, I don't think we've been talking much Ebola on this program yet. But it's time. Nigeria declared a state of emergency yesterday, and that is a massive country declaring a state of emergency. And many in the World Health Organization, and especially Doctors Without Borders, are saying this is good, and this is what nations in West Africa should be doing, because it should be a priority, and because the amount of deaths has now climbed, I forget what the official number is, but it's above 900. And this now involves Sierra Leone, Liberia, Nigeria, as I mentioned, and there's probably one or two more countries this is touched on. It's spreading. In both Liberia and Sierra Leone, this week we saw what they call the blockade of cities to keep outsiders from coming in. This is some of their attempts to keep Ebola from spreading. From what I understand, Tim, it spreads via actual contact, right? So it's not like it's airborne. That would be extremely difficult. But still, contact with people. The problem here, one of the reasons is burial practices, right? So if someone with Ebola dies, there's a tradition in some countries and some cultures of cleaning the body. That in itself will spread Ebola. So that's one thing that they've got to address with people. The hard part, what many workers from the World Health Organization are saying, is that people don't have a lot of trust for the health services. And I guess when you see the photos of people wearing, you know, what look like medical spacesuits, this could scare people even more. So are they listening to what they need to do, not just that something bad is going on? But this is, obviously, this is making headlines all over the world. And Ebola is back in a big way in the world. And I'm reading reports in the U.S. A lot of people were upset because I guess one Ebola victim was flown to the CDC, the Center for Disease Control in Georgia. And many people said, how could you bring someone with Ebola to our country? You know, and they made this special interior of a plane. But, you know, these kind of outbreaks, of course, are global now. You can't even pretend that it's just going to sit in Sierra Leone and not travel. Now, many airlines are stopping their... this is the summer of airlines announcing we're not going places, whether it's for war or now disease. Many airlines have canceled going to West Africa right now until this crisis ends.
Yeah, I mean... The case you mentioned of the two U.S. citizens who were infected with Ebola, they were actually doctors who were working there trying to help. And somehow they also caught the virus. And they were close to dying. I just read it about this. There was a man and a woman. And the man was, you know, he was already in the final stage. His body was covered with red. Everything was a total mess, and he couldn't breathe anymore, and so on. And they flew in a new medicine that is still in the process of being developed, and which they didn't know it would work, which they have never ever used on humans before. And they gave him an injection, and it worked. Until the point that he was, you know, he could breathe again. It was sort of okay and was capable of, you know, talking to his wife on the telephone. And in that stage, that's when they brought him back. So it's not that they flew out somebody who was like in a terminal disease moment. And it's not yet clear if this is going to solve the problem for him or is this just a temporary solution. But I know that the what's the institute in the US that is dealing with allowing medicine?
The FDA. Yeah.
FDA, yeah. They have now made an exemption, so this new serum is being brought into this area, and I don't know if this is going to, you know, help. But it has at least helped. But the general problem is traffic, tourism, you know, globalism has sort of led to the situation where this fast exchange of people and other goods, you know, is sort of spreading everything very, very, very quickly. And that's why this Ebola crisis is so problematic for not only for West Africa, but the rest of the world too.
Hmm. Yeah. There was an Onion article, not that we should ever mention Onion articles, but the headline, if I could read it to you, it was experts, Ebola vaccine, at least 50 white people away. All right, never mind. It's the disease is still at least 50 white people away from the vaccine for the disease is 50 white people away from being developed, but we're well on our way. Oh, anyway, you'd have to see it. Never mind. So that's the story as I've seen it so far. But the question is, you know, how far does this go, and will these countries declare states of emergency and ask for the help when they need it? That part is still not very clear to me if they will or won't. But to see that Nigeria would do it is a pretty big deal. I mean, that is a massive country with a lot of resources on its own. So now calling for international help, well, that could be a good step and people will follow. All right, let's go somewhere else. Now, a story that we missed here on News of the World, although we have always come back to it over the years. When the Malaysia airliner was shot down, it sort of became so loud that other stories were pushed to the side, at least here. And what happened around the same week that the plane was down, another ship of migrants capsized on its way to, Europe, but they always end up in Lampedusa. In is that considered Italy or is that Malta? Well, in the Mediterranean, right?
It's Italy.
Yeah. And so... The headline at that time, and it's confirmed, was 181 people died when a boat capsized on its way to Lampedusa. And it's been a summer, in fact, of many more migrants, maybe than any past year, trying to make their way to Europe. It's estimated at this point, even not just in southern Europe, in Calais, the very famous port where a lot of trucks and I guess the train goes through there too, the channel, goes to the UK, there are actually... over 1,000 people, refugees, undocumented, waiting to try and find a way to get into the UK. And I read this week, moving from the story of boat people to people trying to get on trucks and trains, the government of Calais in France is asking for help because they don't have enough staff to help or even try to secure transportation because people are trying to grab onto, if you've ever taken the Eurostar, you've seen the fences around the train so that people can't grab onto the bottom, often ending up in their own death or injury. And trucks, it's the same thing. People are trying to jump into trucks, jump under trucks. And so now the UK is sending police into Calais that are going to be stationed there. But this crisis is massive in Europe. And, you know, it's amazing because it takes place in these little... Well, they're not little, but these places where we don't see, right? Whether it's an island off of Italy or it's a city in northern France where 1,000 or so people from Sudan, Eritrea, Afghanistan are camped in a forest or living in abandoned buildings. I mean, this is reality here in Europe right now, and it's perhaps one of the most underreported stories. Politically, what to do, you know, how to handle this. So many people wanting to get into the UK, trying to find a way. I mean, I'm tempted to say, why don't we help Calais develop more economically? Maybe people can stay in Calais, but, you know, can Calais, the city, even handle this many people settling there? So it's such a crisis in Europe to understand how to deal with refugees and you know, first, and also not allow people to die on boats and ships and trying to get in and under cars. I mean, this is so many layers to this issue, but it's been a bad summer.
Helping Calais is probably not going to help. You know, it's going to help with the result of this crisis, but the main problem is the lack of help in these areas where the people are coming from. I mean, not always easily done, because we have this continued crisis in Syria, in Libya now, with new fighting, which we haven't really touched on too, as far as I know. Just so much happening in this Middle East, Northern African area, and also further down below. I mean, we've been talking about the situation in Mali, in Sudan. Yeah. We've touched many places. Eritrea is a continuous pain in the ass. So all these areas are sort of sending out people who just look for, you know, some situation that is at least some a bit better than what they're experiencing at their home area, and that's pretty bad. So that's why they are spending so much money getting into boats, you know, where people are making a lot of money off as well. Yeah. So this is another problem. Yeah. I think what's lacking here is that Europe doesn't really face the situation as it is and doesn't really come up with a plan how to improve these areas. I mean, it's not easy. It's not easily improved. Mm-hmm. We've seen this repeatedly in many of the examples also, including those areas we've been already talking about this program. But I don't think there's any way around this.
Yeah. Yeah. It's just amazing how much this can swell, you know, when you're talking about thousands of people. And then even just in terms of health, right, in these places, on this island of Lampedusa, I mean, there must be thousands of stories, horrible stories, and the health conditions that they're living in, you know, these services from the EU, I forget what they're called, but we'll call them border patrol, for lack of a better word. You know, they have to handle health needs, shelter, and the, you know, more and more people arriving, it's so difficult. Even this broken system that they've created for housing people temporarily in this non-status, right? They're not officially here, but they're not officially back there either. And you know, we're talking about Ebola, for example. You know, that a crisis like that could emerge in such a situation, or other diseases as well. So it's just from one bad story or many bad stories, they just mutate into even worse when you arrive in so-called Europe. So I always try to keep an eye out, and we'll link to this article about what a summer it's been. Let's go to a little history. I saw this Cambodia in the news a few times this week because two former Khmer Rouge leaders, one known as, I'll go by the nickname, Brother Number Two, officially Nuon Che. He is 88 years old, and his co-defendant Q Samphan, who doesn't have a nickname that I see, they were found guilty of crimes against humanity during the Khmer Rouge regime. They oversaw a lot of the deaths. Of course, 1.7 million people killed during that regime. They, of course, claim to have no knowledge or not, at least not be guilty. They say Vietnamese troops, when they came, they're the ones who did all the killing. But these are some of the few, despite their old age at this point, some of the few people from the Khmer Rouge that have actually been sentenced. And it's a very big deal, not just for Cambodia, but I think for international law, the idea that this can happen. They still face another trial, hard to believe, but they still face another trial for genocide. But the current sentencing is a life sentence anyway, but still there'll be another trial. The press is also pointing out it's unlikely that any more Khmer Rouge figures will stand trial, which I didn't realize, because there are still plenty of other people who had leadership positions. But the government in Cambodia, of course, their prime minister, who's been around for a very long time, Hun Sen, he was involved with Khmer Rouge, although, you know, lower ranks. He's slowing things down. He doesn't want to see this continue, according to all reports. This is just one of those moments in history. You know, two more figures finally get officially judged. And at the same time, a diary, a very rare for a time where people were having everything taken from them and, you know, forget writing and paper. But a diary has surfaced from a victim who was a school teacher before he was taken by the Khmer Rouge and sent on these long marches and working for a couple of years with no food or very little food. I read the diary this morning. I'll link to it. It is every bit as bad as you would expect, but he describes in detail what he eats, what he's given to eat, what he's forced to do, and life under the Khmer Rouge, and it's pretty sad, of course. So this is the word coming out of Cambodia this week. Some history still being, of course, resolved and dealt with.
Well, at least it's dealt with. I was always sort of tiny bit surprised that this was actually happening, that the society is actually, you know, managed to get around these crimes, because there are so many countries where this didn't even happen, you know.
Yeah.
Although there's a continuous history of these kind of crimes.
Yeah. Yeah, it is a rare case in the world, and a lot of people who are, you know, supporters of the idea of international law, and they look at this as, well, maybe slow, maybe late, but it happened. You know, I'm talking about the trial and the judgment, and you know, evidence being laid out and everything. So, in that sense, I don't think it's an overstatement to call this a, you know, progress for international law anyway, or at least, you know, it exists, proof that it exists or can exist. Huh. Yeah. All right. So from a little history, present history. Let's go to a little business, because I think this is significant and eventually touches on everything. There was a big business move last week. General Electric, the big U.S., I can't even call them, they're a multinational corporation that does a whole list of things from coffee machines to nuclear weapons. They were trying to get more, but they were able to buy Alstom, the big French, what do we call them? energy / transportation. They make the TGV, for example.
Yes.
A lot of the power grid in France is run by Alstom. I guess they're France's Siemens, right? Siemens Germany, as Alstom is to France.
Yeah, it's technology industry in general. Yeah. Big stuff.
So GE has bought successfully, so it seems, their energy unit. So this is going to concern some aspects of, gas, power. What is their big power generation, basically? Anything related to that, GE will now be the owner of. Alstom and the French government made this deal so that Alstom still exists, because it's such an important, not just symbol, but a literal employer in France. So that Alstom will still exist. A lot of those trains and all that will still be made by Alstom. But when it comes to energy, those things will now be GE. And this is a huge deal to, you know, GE was already enormous, and now they have a big operation in Europe. I already heard from some of my friends in Portugal who work for Alstom. They're trying to figure out if they're going to keep their jobs or not, because that's always a risk when your company gets bought by such a large multinational. I told them to be very afraid, but they say so far, like all big acquisitions, GE promises to be to not just fire everybody and to be fair and so forth. But I always think this is what you say the first year, and then you cut them the second year. Apparently, this is a big move, because what GE wanted and Alstom has is gas and steam turbine, a big part of the gas and steam turbine business. And this kind of connects in some ways to our discussion of where energy and the focus on energy in Europe is going. Especially when you talk about gas and steam turbines, I don't know, become more and more important then if we're not looking to Russia and, or maybe in cooperation with Russia.
As far as I understand it, it's also a general technology that you need in general, totally independent, or at least somewhat independent of what the origin of the energy is. You know, there's always this process where you have to turn it into into electricity, and that's where mm-hmm. the turbines come in. So, it's an important market. Siemens wanted to have it. I don't really know why the French government initially rejected the American offer and then wasn't really happy about the offer that Siemens did as well, and then supported General Electric, because, you know, France, America, it's never been the best relationship when it comes to these things. It's also a very strong foothold for an American company on the European market. You know, my expectation at least was that somehow the maybe even the German and the French government is getting the act together, sort of like mm-hmm. keep it European. They didn't do that. I don't know why. I don't understand enough of these issues to be able to say anything about this.
Yeah. It's amazing how big corporations can get, and I know how dumb that sounds, but like I just saw that, what was it, Fox wanted to buy Time Warner in the US. I mean, at some point we arrive in this moment in history where companies are, of course, global and huge and doing so many different things, and then they go up to another company that is global and huge and say, yeah, we're gonna have you now, or at least a piece of you. So, you know, this Fox and Time Warner isn't happening at the moment, but yeah, GE buys Alstom. I mean, this is massive. You know, the amount of countries that are impacted by this move, it's a long list, even though we always start with France and the US because that's, you know, the main powers behind these two. So I thought I would mention that because it will probably play a role in a lot of things going on in the next few years.
Yeah, and if you put the economies of certain countries against the money that certain companies are actually wielding, you know, you'll find Apple within the top 100 of countries. Quite a few countries on this planet who are not moving as much money and as much power as a single company that's just basically a few people, you know.
Yeah.
At least compared to countries. You know.
True. So now moving to the last part of our program. This week we do have a news source. I mentioned them before, so let's officially add them. I checked, they weren't on the list. Bloomberg. No, not the mayor of New York, the former mayor of New York, although he is behind them, but the news service. And, you know, initially I wouldn't have them as a news source because they're so focused on money and business and, you know, your house could be on fire and they would have an article about how much the contents cost. I would usually be looking for the details of the people inside. But I have to give some credit, of course, to Bloomberg because they don't just describe the numbers, although they are very meticulous with that. But, you know, they've come to become this, business focused, but that is behind so many of the news stories that we look at. So just in terms of Ukraine this week, a lot of the articles that I found as I was searching for any news source with extensive coverage, Bloomberg had quite a lot about the numbers, about how this impacts people, markets, everything. So I recommend them, and we're adding them to the list, Bloomberg.com, of course, a huge empire of financial news and every kind of news.
That looks like a mix of economy and politics, which is not surprising given the stronger relationship these two areas have. And in that sense, there's probably no real... they might have a tendency to report more on economy and have certain sections that go into much more detail than probably CNN does. But in the end, they're dealing with the same situations and delivering updates to this. And they're sort of... On the same page as many other big news organizations.
Yeah.
News as such doesn't really qualify as a business anymore. You know, you really have to go broader.
Yeah. You have to have some edge. Like we have our edge. We're an edgy news program.
True, our niche.
Yeah. Say controversial things. Read from The Onion, even when it's not very...
appropriate.
Appropriate. Sorry. So that about does it for this week's edition of news, and we're going on a little news vacation, right, Tim? What are we talking? 1 week or 2 weeks?
At least there will be a break of a week, and we'll see how this turns out.
All right, I'm heading down to the motherland to hang out in Portugal and pick fruit, but I'll have my microphone handy, And we will surely be back as the summer gets older. Back with more news, of course.
Yes, that's it.
Yeah. All right. Thanks for listening, everyone. And of course, comments. You know the website, newsoftheworld.com, and links to all the news. So you know. And on thanks for all the flatters and all the feedback. All right. See you next time. Bye. Goodbye.